My name is Jonathan Klins, and this is U.S. History. Today, I have released the first episode of a podcast that I have high hopes for, a podcast that will shed light on the history of the United States in a unique way that is enjoyable to listen to and is as accurate as possible. As a history nerd, one of the things I hear a lot is that history is extremely boring, consisting of names, dates, and places that mean nothing in today's world. This is more of an indictment of the way history is taught rather than history itself being unpalatable. History classes in high school and even in college survey courses often force teachers to hit the highlights of history so that they can say the student left their class knowing certain things about history while leaving the student to fill in all the holes between these high points. For example, the average study of American history does not spend a whole lot of time on the Native Americans. You might hear the tribes X, Y, and Z sided with the British in this war, and tribes A, B, and C sided with the Americans in that war, but the names escape you, and there is not much more said on the subject. Students walk away believing that all Native Americans were pretty much the same without recognizing that there was a massive patchwork of tribes in North America with unique cultures that often played an essential role in the success or failure of settlements, early wars, and other areas of life that we will cover in this podcast once the time comes. The bigger problem is this: that style of teaching doesn't actually stick in the minds of students beyond the final test. You know those classes, the day after class ends. What was the class again? I can't. U.S. history? What? The guy on the dollar bill, Washington? Yeah, those classes. If you don't believe me, 2018 poll done by the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation shows only 36% of Americans can pass a basic citizenship test with a passing score of 60%. That percentage drops to just 19% when only looking at respondents under the age of 45. Quote, only 13% of those surveyed knew when the U.S. Constitution was ratified, even on a multiple-choice exam similar to the citizenship exam, with most incorrectly thinking it occurred in 1776. More than half of respondents, 60%, didn't know which countries the United States fought in World War II, and despite recent media spotlight on the U.S. Supreme Court, 57% of those surveyed did not know how many justices actually serve on the nation's highest court, end quote. In addition, 37% of respondents believed Benjamin Franklin invented the light bulb. 72% either did not know or were unsure of which states were part of the 13 original states. And while these last oopsies were committed by a minority, 12% of respondents believed Dwight Eisenhower led troops in the Civil War. 6% believed he led troops in the Vietnam War. And 2%, this is my favorite, personally believed the Cold War was fought over climate change. Yeah. This is where I believe this podcast will be different from other American histories you may have heard. The poll I cited not only shows a historical illiteracy in Americans, but also shows how little historical context these people remember. Ben Franklin died 89 years before Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. The Civil War and World War II occurred 80 years apart from each other and under very different circumstances, but because history is taught as simply names, dates, and places, it is extremely easy to confuse a couple of them. It is my goal to provide context to the major events you have heard, shed light on parts that deserve more inspection, and do so while maintaining the integrity of the story of America. The show will begin by exploring the time between the discovery of the New World and the founding of the Jamestown colony in 1607, first from the perspective of the European powers, and then from the perspective of the natives. An important thing to note is that because this is an American history show, both episodes will be done with an eye on North America. Therefore, I will not be focusing on the specifics regarding the Spanish administration of their conquered lands, nor will I focus specifically on the Central or South American native civilizations. I will, however, get into more specifics regarding the native civilizations who were in North America, especially the eastern seaboard, as well as the colonists who settled there. Episodes 3 through 6 will discuss the creation of the 13 colonies until 1763, beginning with the New England colonies, continuing with the middle colonies, and ending with the southern colonies. After that, I will progress the story of the native tribes to 1763 and explore their unique cultures as well as their relations with all powers in the region in 1763. From there, we will go into revolutionary history. With all the business matters set aside, please enjoy the rest of this content. Or, you know, don't. This is America, after all. Everyone knows that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. For any of you wondering why I choose to start back here, as opposed to when the first successful English colony was founded in 1607, I choose 1492 for several reasons. One, it is important to highlight the variety of ways that the joining of the New World and the Old World impacted both realms positively and negatively. In addition, many of the events outside of this century impact the colonies after this. Finally, in talking to people outside the history field, I've discovered some interesting, you might call it, perspectives on the early explorers and the natives who lived in the New World. Because of this, I'd like to flesh out some of the details of this time. Our story begins in 1492 with the discovery of North and South America. But why? Why 1492? Why Christopher Columbus and why the Spanish? The answer to these questions begins in 1452 and the fall of Constantinople. From a symbolic standpoint, 1452 is massive, as it marks the last vestige of the Roman Empire falling. However, the practical ramifications were far greater. Because Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, Turkey, controlled the one port that connected the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, the loss of it meant that the only way to acquire goods from India and China was by trading through Muslim middlemen, or Italian middlemen, from the city-states of Genoa and Venice. As a result of the heavily restricted and expensive choices to acquire Far East goods for Europeans, leading maritime powers, Portugal and Spain, began looking for a sea route to China and India to avoid the hate of Muslim and Italian middlemen. Just to put that in perspective, the Portuguese and Spanish really believed it was more profitable to see if they could go around the continent of Africa rather than deal with middlemen who gouged them on Far East goods. It was during this time of exploration that Christopher Columbus was beginning his sailing career. Columbus had been around ships most of his life, growing up in Genoa, Italy. He moved to Portugal shortly after almost being killed by pirates off the coast of Lisbon, Portugal, and began sailing with the Portuguese to trading posts they had acquired along the African coast and the Canary Islands, an island chain just off the coast of Morocco. It was during this time that he concluded that it was his destiny to sail west to China over the Atlantic and convert the Emperor of China to Christendom. He believed this was possible for a couple of reasons, the first being trade winds. During his time sailing along the African coastline, the Portuguese realized that different parts of the ocean had different wind patterns and used those patterns to their advantage on voyages from Africa by allowing the wind to carry them northwest to a certain point, then having gone far enough north, turning around and taking advantage of the easterly winds to take them back to Europe. Think of slingshot. Columbus believed one could take those westerly winds all the way to Asia, and the easterly winds all the way back. This brings us to the second reason he believed such a journey was possible: the size of the Earth. Columbus believed the Earth to be about 18,000 miles around and Asia to be a mere 3,500 miles away from the coast of Europe. This disagreed with what leading minds of the time believed about the size of the Earth, who agreed with the calculations of ancient Greek mathematicians who had estimated the Earth to be approximately 25,000 miles around. Now, I'm sorry to disappoint all who believed Columbus to be the only man sensible enough to believe the Earth was round, living in a world with a bunch of short-sighted, flat-Earth Neanderthals. Quite the opposite, the scholars of the time were absolutely right. We now know the Earth to be 24,859.73 miles, around, So where did we get all this idea that the 15th century astronomers believed the Earth to be flat? Well, we can thank Washington Irving and his 1828 biography of Christopher Columbus for that myth. Irving, who also wrote fictional classics Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, felt the biography of Columbus needed a little pizzazz, and so he threw that little tidbit into the story to make it just a bit juicier. The legend grew and eventually became historical fact, and is still widely believed. Columbus began by petitioning the crown of Portugal in the early 1480s to sail west for China, and was promptly ridiculed by the king's astronomers as a doofus because everyone knew the Earth was 25,000 miles around. He then went to Spain in 1487, where he was also rejected, as they were in the middle of an effort to expel the Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula in the Granada War, in addition to the fact that the astronomers thought he was a doofus. In 1488, Columbus sent his brother to France and England, who also laughed at his proposal. This cycle of petition and failure continued until 1492, when Spain finally agreed to underwrite his voyage westward. Two major things had changed since the first time Columbus came to their court in 1487. In 1488, Portuguese explorer Bartholomew Diaz rounded the southern tip of Africa, becoming the first European to do so. This meant the Portuguese had a big maritime and trade advantage, as they had discovered a way around using the accursed middlemen that inflated Indian and Chinese goods, placing the rest of Europe on notice. The other major reason Spain decided it could afford such a risk was they had successfully expelled the Muslim threat from their land and had the discretionary money to spend on the voyage and not be too punished should the men and ships not return. Despite the astronomers in Spanish court still saying that Columbus was a two-bit crook and had no clue what he was talking about with this small earth business, the Spanish crown decided it was worth the risk. Now, although Columbus failed to reach China in any of his four excursions across the Atlantic, he did manage to discover the presence of two continents and kick off an age of exploration that would define what many historians view as the beginning of modernity in many senses. Solid consolation prize. When Columbus returned to Spain in March 1493, he declared he had discovered lands just off the coast of Asia, and that the land was fertile, and the Indians, quote-unquote, who lived there, were very, very wealthy. Spain quickly sent Columbus back with more men and ships to explore and colonize this new land he found. But Spain was no longer alone. Because Spain and Portugal were the two leading maritime powers at the time, it is Portugal who next enters our story. Portugal was in the process of exploring the African coastline, and had also discovered and colonized a few islands off the African coast, the Canary Islands we previously mentioned. When Spain discovered new land, the Portuguese were all of a sudden very afraid that the Spanish were encroaching on Portuguese ambition, and the Spanish felt the same way. So in 1494, they each took their grievances to the Pope, who negotiated the Treaty of Tordesillas, which drew a north-south boundary line west of the Azores Islands, an island chain in the middle of the Atlantic. The Portuguese had exclusive rights of exploration and settlement east of the Azores, and the Spanish had exclusive rights west of the Azores. Following the return of Columbus with the announcement of a route to Asia and the promise of wealth, all the countries of Europe became far more interested in exploration. In 1497, John Cabot discovered Newfoundland, again in search of Asia, sailing for the English. In 1502, Amerigo Vespucci sailed the coast of South America for Portugal and discovered that continents, not just islands, lay between Europe and Asia to the west. The continents were called North and South America in his honor. Overseas exploration continued well into the 18th century. Spain began their time in the New World by colonizing the islands of Hispaniola, modern-day Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and the island of Cuba. The first decade of colonization for the Spanish was completely disastrous, resulting in the loss of around two-thirds of the Spanish colonists. This came as a result of poor and filthy travel conditions weakening the Spanish to the point that they could not raise enough food for survival once they arrived, and dying shortly after landing. Now, as bad as the first decade of settlement was for the Spanish, enough survived to make the settlement work. Sadly, the native Taino people were not as fortunate. A combination of a complete lack of resistance to European diseases and the Spanish colonizers forcing them to work in newly created mines, plantations, ranches, and farms resulted in the near extermination of the Taino on Hispaniola from a 1492 population of over 300,000 to a 1548 population of just 500. With that, we get to the gut-wrenchingly steep costs of two unique people groups coming into contact. For the next few episodes, much of the conversation around the native peoples will be first contact, followed by horrible epidemics ravaging them. Before continuing with how Spain conquered large parts of North and South America, I would like to make one thing very clear. While the presence of the Europeans may have spread the diseases that would spell the doom of an enormous amount of lives, the Europeans did not maliciously spread these diseases, nor were they unaffected by these diseases. Going forward, I will not be judging the European colonizers for things that were out of their control. Now, I won't shy away from acts of malice or evil committed by either the Europeans or the natives, but things such as disease will be considered by this podcast as tragedy. Nothing more, nothing less. With the rapid decline of the native labor force, Spanish settlers made incursions into modern Mexico and the southeast United States to sustain the working force on Hispaniola and Cuba. It was amid these raids that an ambitious young subordinate commander in Cuba heard of a rich and populous land in central Mexico. This commander defied the authority of the governor of Cuba and went on an unauthorized mission with 600 men to conquer this rich kingdom known as the Aztecs. Through leveraging their enemies in cunning diplomacy and as a good commander, Hernan Cortes conquered the Aztecs and destroyed their capital of Tenochtitlan. Cortes's effort was aided, of course, by the smallpox epidemic that wiped out by around half of the Aztec defenders. You'll notice this pattern in the Spanish story of conquest. First contact is usually followed by either war or an epidemic, sometimes both, and the inability of the natives to resist the European diseases result in the Spanish being able to successfully colonize large tracts of Central and South America with relatively few people. The non-human impact of these two realms colliding after thousands of years apart is equally astonishing to the human impact. The great mixing of plants and animals known to us as the Columbian Exchange permanently altered the world as we know it. This episode, we will discuss the European side of the Columbian Exchange, and next time, we will discuss the impact on North America. The Columbian Exchange is a broad term describing the meshing of all diseases, plants, animals, and humans post-1492. One caveat I would like to include in this is the exportation of minerals from the New World. For a product to be included in a quote-unquote exchange, there would have to be something in return for all the minerals mined from the New World and distributed throughout Eurasia. Since that is not the case with precious metals and jewels, it is not often mentioned in conversations about the Columbian Exchange. Now, until the last 50 years or so of study, discussion of this exchange between Europe and the Americas was limited to just plants and animals traded, and the movement of humans from Europe to the Americas, as well as the forced movement of Africans to the Americas. However, more recent study of this time has revealed disease to be a major factor in how early American history came to be. Because of a variety of factors that we will cover next time when we talk about the native civilizations, Native Americans were decimated by Old World diseases. While smallpox headlines the parade of diseases that afflicted the native population, they were also affected by measles, mumps, typhus, chickenpox, malaria, and yellow fever, just to name a few. At this time, there is a lively debate in the historical community as to how many natives died from Old World diseases. The estimates range from 20 million to over 100 million with the high variance coming from disagreements over the original size of the 1492 population. No matter what the actual number is, everyone agrees, though, that the introduction of Old World diseases to the New World resulted in one of the largest and most devastating epidemics in world history. The exchange of plants between the New and Old World were also highly impactful in a variety of ways. The staple foods from the New World were instrumental in one of the largest population growth periods in European history, allowing Europe to recover from the decimation of population they had just experienced with the bubonic plague, wiping out anywhere from a fourth to half of European population over the course of the 14th century. The staple crops of which I speak are manioc, maize, also known as corn, and potatoes. Manioc is a plant where the nutrients are found in the root and can only be grown in tropical areas. This plant took hold in Africa and has been a staple crop for them for centuries. Maize and potatoes are also very hardy plants that produce greater calories per hectare, about 2.5 acres, with maize producing average yields of 7.3 million calories per hectare, and potatoes producing 7.5 million calories per hectare. That is significantly larger than the average calories per hectare of wheat, barley, and oats, the previous staple crops of Europe, which produced 4.2 million, 5.1 million, and 5.5 million calories per hectare on average, respectively. In addition, maize and potatoes could also be planted in locations that did not support European staple crops, with maize being able to thrive in sandier soil and potatoes being able to survive in colder climates. The combination of these two crops producing greater yields on the same land and expanding the amount of farmable land in Europe resulted in extreme population growth. Even after the population of Europe caught up to the food supply, Europeans continued to multiply because they had two continents to send those that continental Europe could not feed. The exchange of plants between the New World and the Old World truly changed the course of European history. Now, the animal exchange was fairly one-sided, as natives before 1492 had only domesticated the dog in North America and llamas and alpacas in South America. Meanwhile, Europe had a wide variety of beasts of burden that had been domesticated over the centuries, including horses, oxen, cows, and pigs. Because the Old World animals were being introduced in the Americas, this exchange largely affected the New World, which we will discuss this impact in much greater detail in the following episode. As with the animals, the flow of people between the New World and Old World was extremely one-sided, with natives only being shipped to Europe as novelties, essentially, and many of those natives who were shipped to Europe ended up dying due to European diseases. As I mentioned when discussing the exchange for plants, the infusion of New World plants in European agriculture allowed Europe to do more than just send out the occasional trader or fisher or conquistador. It allowed Europe to grow and expand into North and South America. The other flow of people originated in Africa, with slave labor being shipped to various plantations, mines, and so on and so forth. Trust me when I tell you there will be much more on this later. Speaking of conquistadors, by the middle of the 16th century, Spain had established administrative apparatuses in both Mexico and Peru, and had bases and plantations throughout the Caribbean islands, Mexico, Central America, and parts of South America. In addition, Spain declared authority over all of North and South America. While they had absolutely no means of enforcing that claim effectively, the declaration, combined with the shiploads of gold and silver coming to Spain, was cause for concern all over Europe. England, France, and the Netherlands were dismayed to find themselves decades behind the Spanish in colonizing and felt that much of the good land in the tropics was already taken. That didn't mean the other European powers planned to simply allow the Spanish to continue ruling the New World alone, though. In a letter from the French King Francis I to Spanish King Charles V regarding the nature of the claims of the New World, circa 1524, quote, "Your Majesty and the King of Portugal have divided the world between you, offering no part of it to me. Show me, I pray you, the will of our father Adam, so that I may see if he has really made you his universal heir. End quote. In other words, I'm going to explore the New World and settle the New World. Go ahead and try and stop me. The other European powers felt the same way and began exploring the New World for themselves. While they initially had little success settling the New World, the English and the French especially turned to skilled sailors to help, quote-unquote, liberate Spanish treasure coming to Europe. Now, the Spanish, of course, referred to such activities as piracy, and were not super big fans of those pirates. During the early 16th century, it was France who led the charge in piracy against the Spanish. However, over the course of the century, England became the premier pirates. The greatest of all these pirates was, of course, Captain Jack Non-fiction version, Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake was far and away the best mariner of his day, and over the course of his career disrupted Spanish shipping repeatedly, becoming the first pirate to steal treasure on the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans, becoming just the second expedition to successfully circumnavigate the globe. The success of Drake and his fellow sea predators further emboldened the English to aggress on Spanish shipping and angered the Spanish to such a degree that then-Spanish King Philip II determined to invade and conquer England. To do so, he sent 130 ships carrying 2,431 cannons and 22,000 sailors and soldiers in 1588, known to history as the Spanish Armada. Although the English were badly outnumbered and outgunned, their ships were smaller, faster, and carried longer-range cannons. These advantages proved to be decisive as the English broke up the Armada, which then was mostly destroyed or crippled by storms in the North and Irish seas while retreating. This, the Spanish building huge fortification networks for their harbors in the New World, and the Spanish being forced to protect their shipments with the building of large galleons with heavy cannon, added up and dampened the profitability of the New World for the Spanish. This allowed the English, the French, and the Dutch time to begin settling colonies of their own in the New World before the Spanish claimed all the land. Finally, I would like to briefly get into the differences between how the Spanish and English settled their colonies. Over the course of the 16th century, about 250,000 people immigrated to New Spain. Most came from the Kingdom of Castile, the more influential of the three kingdoms, the Crown of Aragon, the Crown of Castile, and the Kingdom of Navarre, that combined to make the Spanish crown in 1469. While all the social classes were participants, most immigrants were ambitious, middle-class people looking to make something of themselves. In addition, almost all of those Spanish immigrants were men. As a result, the Spanish men did not take very long at all to mix with the native women, and so New Spain was a very unique blend of Spanish and indigenous people. From an administrative standpoint, Spain wanted to be consulted at every turn. And so, although it took time to spend 6 months to send messages back and forth across the Atlantic, making this method of administration completely impractical, the culture of top-down administration was set. The British colonies were quite different from those of New Spain. Because 16th century England was in the process of establishing private property and enclosing many fields that peasants used communally, there was a growing population of landless peasants. As the end of the 16th century approached, many early promoters of English colonization overseas were encouraging investors to buy into the creation of a colony in Virginia, to send the landless peasants to and have them produce crops that the English climate could not support. These peasants included whole families, as opposed to just men, as in the Spanish colonization process. This, along with the lack of immediate wealth to be found in North America, led to colonies filled with families of low birth, being independent of the English crown, having to make their own livelihood. Finally, because the English monarchy was far less wealthy than the Spanish monarchy, the English were forced to subcontract the colonization process to private investors and had very little control over the colonies early on. As we will soon see, this had dramatic consequences on the culture of the English North American colonies. That is all the content I have for you today. But before we formally conclude this episode, I feel I should answer two questions I have wrestled with as I study early American history. One, is the story of America worth learning? And two, is our history something to be proud of? Now, I'm going to assume that all of you listening to this podcast feel that history is important and worth studying. However, the level of pride one has in their country's history is something quite different and far more difficult to discern. As we travel through the past together, what I hope to leave with you, the listener, is that though our nation's history is filled with periods of time where we failed to live up to the creed in our Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, America has continually progressed toward that sentiment. This, of course, is because American history is filled with imperfect people who are products of their time. Despite the flaws and imperfections of our nation's history and the people who made it what it is, Americans have a great deal to be proud of in creating and protecting a country that has fought for every individual to be free. Americans take for granted a reverence in the Constitution, an idealism to make our country better, police who don't take bribes, a military that doesn't run the country, and the freedom to speak out for or against anything you want without fear of government reprisal. A brief study of world history and a quick glance at the world today makes all of those assumptions appear quite silly. And the fact that we as Americans hold these notions just shows how spoiled we are to live in this country and have our history of protecting freedom, however imperfectly we may have been at doing so. Next time on This Is U.S. History, we will cover the major native tribes and civilizations along the eastern seaboard and their early interactions with the Europeans during the 16th century. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope to see you next time.